Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is coming into the back half of April, and this is another episode of The Three Horsemen. And we are once again down one member tonight, so I want to say hello to my ever-faithful, ever-industrious co-host, Fred Kish.
Well, I was going to try and do a John Stevens and go, hello! But this is Fred Kish. Fred Kish at Twitter and blogging at the Bernal Alpha, and still in the midst of the Project from Hell, so scattered as usual.
Yeah, I hear that. I'm in the middle of NBA playoffs, so yeah, I got another week or two of that madness going on.
At least you know when there's
tonight,
an end date.
Huh?
At least you know there's an end date for that.
Yeah. And for this episode, we are joined from SFF Audio, another veteran of the podcast minds, Mr. Jesse Willis.
Hello.
Yeah. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I did a podcast this morning, and I had a busy day, but I've been looking forward to talk about this for a long time. I didn't know how to do a show on it on my own podcast, but I'm welcome to talk about it with you, so that's going to work out.
So how many episodes are you guys up to at this point?
It's 400-something, I think. Weekly.
Weekly, yep, I know that. And just for the listeners out there, I highly recommend the site, even if you don't listen to the podcast, because it's a wonderful resource for the world of pulp.
You know, we have another podcast as well, which I do weekly, crazily enough. It's called Reading Short and Deep, and the idea is it's short subject,
like,
so only half hour maximum to read and approximately half hour to listen to. And I do that with Eric Rabkin, a pretty famous SF scholar who used to do it at a university.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've listened to that quite a bit.
We will fulfill our contractual obligation and state that. Of course, since you have Paul Weimer on your one podcast, that always adds at least 30 minutes or so to the each episode, right?
Absolutely. Okay, he's a super knowledgeable guy.
Oh, yeah.
He is. No doubt about it.
We have to fulfill that contractual obligation of mentioning at least once every episode or so.
Yep. So the reason we have Jesse on is because for the last, 14 months, I've been saying that we were going to talk about Alan Moore's Providence once the series was complete. And since the last issue came out in the past couple of weeks, we are going to do that. However, because the last issue acted as more of a wrap-up for not only Providence, but the previous two Lovecraft-based miniseries that he did, we sort of have to talk about those as well.
Mm-hmm. And
there will be spoilers.
Yes.
So, big, big spoiler alert. So, the books we're going to talk about starts off with the sequence that he did. Started off with a two-issue miniseries called The Courtyard way back in 2003. And The Courtyard was the story of a cop named Aldo Sachs, who
FBI
had masterminded...
Agent.
FBI agent, I'm sorry. Who had masterminded a theory of information and pattern recognition and stuff like that. And he is sent undercover to go find a drug dealer named Johnny Carcosa, and who has been pushing a drug. Aklo, am I pronouncing it correctly?
I think so. Aklo?
Yep.
Yeah. What he learns in the second issue of that is that Aklo is not a drug. It is, in fact, a language, and it's the language of the old ones. And his brain gets all kinds of scrambled and expanded, and he goes on to become a bit of a maniac. This was followed up by a series called Neonomicon, in which we meet another Fed, Agent Breers, and she goes undercover first off to find Carcosa and then to sort of infiltrate a Lovecraft-oriented sex club, and which turns out to not go well for her. Basically, she's imprisoned. She is raped by not only the sex club, but an old one who lives in a pool that they keep underneath their little shop. And she has a brief meeting with Johnny Carcosa, who we sort of figure out is some kind of an avatar of the old ones, and promptly finds out that she is not only pregnant, but she is pregnant with Cthulhu. And the series ends with her sort of coming to accept this. So everyone thought that was going to be the end of the sequence. And then Alan Moore said he had one more he was going to do. It was going to be 12 issues, and it was going to be called Providence, and it was going to act as both a prequel and a sequel. Now, something we should mention here is that it was pretty clear in those first two miniseries that we were not talking about the modern world. There were lots of differences that we saw, the domes over the major cities, the sort of implicit racism and sexism that we see in primarily the courtyard, but to an extent, Neonomicon take on different forms. There's different subcultures and stuff like this that are going on. So when we get around to Providence, it opens in 1913, I believe. Or are we after that? No, we're after that. 1919.
Yeah.
After World War One.
Yeah, after World War One, and just before Prohibition.
And just before the big Red Scare and the policeman strikes and things like that.
Yes. And we meet a man by the name of Robert Black, who works for a paper in New York City called The Herald. And an off comment by a secretary in the newspaper sends him off to look for information regarding a fictitious book, which supposedly drove people mad when they read it. In short, Black starts traveling through over to Red Hook and up into New England, and he meets characters who have uncanny resemblances to characters from Lovecraft stories, although he appears to be meeting all of them before the events of the Lovecraft stories, if that makes sense.
Right.
And he begins to piece together a weird little secret history of the secret organization and the odd events that occurred around it.
But we should point out, even stepping back one level, that you'll come across names in the series. For example, Robert Black could be Robert Block,
yeah,
who wrote Psycho, who appeared as Robert Blake in a Lovecraft story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there's a famous Lovecraft story, Pickman's Model. There's a similar name within one of these issues of Providence. So there's a lot of, I mean, Moore is kind of doing what many, many Lovecraftian authors did, adding to the canon, playing with the, you know, adding real people into it, changing things slightly. So just be aware that there's like all these literary jokes going on.
Mm. Yes.
It's very high level. It's not for everybody. It's basically you have to be deep into Lovecraft to really appreciate almost anything.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that up, because that's one thing I wanted to, the one last thing I want to add to my synopsis is, we the reader see and draw conclusions that Robert Black does not. Mm. And it becomes apparent that this entire hidden America that he's looking for already knows about him and already has plans for him. And those plans involve him meeting Lovecraft, who they consider the Redeemer, and bringing about the world that was but no longer is. And everything moves at sometimes a glacial pace, but along the way he goes through a few rather horrible experiences. But I do want to point what Jesse, what you just said. This is not a book for people who aren't fans of Lovecraft or who aren't familiar, let's go that far, aren't familiar with Lovecraft. It is similar in his approach to how he did League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. There are characters who are in there who, if you are not familiar with them outside the story, there are references and lines of dialogue and little bits of visual irony that you won't get, that you won't pick up. Fortunately, the one other thing I want to add to this, because as I read this series, as I do with just about any Alan Moore series, I spent my time reading the annotations. And for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it was Jess Nevin's fantastic annotations that he did for it. But for this, it was Facts in the Case of Alan Moore's Providence, which was a annotation site put together by Alex Kay. And we'll put a link up there. And panel by panel, he does a pretty thorough exploration of all the content that Moore is putting in, both in the words, in what's being said, and in what's being shown in the illustrations.
We should mention that this site is inspired pretty much by a similar analysis of The Courtyard, which Anthony Johnston did around the time that comic came out.
Yeah.
So if you can find that book, seek it out, because that's really worth it.
Yeah. It's it is literally an exercise in people reading stuff into the works of Alan Moore. Yeah, no. So what I personally found interesting about the series as it was going on was the fact that he was taking all of these Lovecraft stories and not only cementing them in a shared universe, but also drawing connections to them, which were not apparent in the original stories. A few connections were sort of made later by other authors, but Moore pretty much decided that all these characters are either familiar with each other or have had some dealings with them. So, anyways, we've got Jesse on here. I guess my first question for you is, what did you take away from the series? What did you think of the series? But did you have any big takeaways from it? Did it meet your expectations? And if so, how?
I didn't really know what to expect. I had read Neonomicon packaged with The Courtyard in a trade paperback, and I was blown away by that. One name that's sort of gone unmentioned so far is Jason Burroughs, who I think contributes incredibly to... I mean, I don't know how detailed those panels are, descriptions by Moore, but I can't imagine that he didn't contribute anything, because they're so good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even if Alan Moore detailed everything out, just getting that on the page is amazing. And his art improved incredibly as well. I don't know if the word improved is right, but I like it more. By the end of Providence, it's just incredible. In The Courtyard, it's good. And, you know, the framing's great, but it's not the same style. So you can sort of read them completely separately over, you know, the course of since 2003 to 2017. But I've been reading Providence sort of, I went back to Neonomicon for this, but the trade of Neonomicon, including Courtyard. But what I would say that's different from what you have said already is that I don't look at it as almost like an overarching plot, because I think it's pretty weak there. Making all the connections between all the stories in each issue doesn't work that well, I would say, as a story. I mean, he pulls it together pretty well, but individually, each issue standing on its own is incredibly powerful, because it's Moore reacting in a very incredibly knowledgeable way to what Lovecraft is either doing or saying, or doesn't even know what's going on about his own writing. So taking the first issue of Providence, it's besides being, you know, an introduction to Robert Black and you know, the city of New York and all of the background for that, it's also the story of Cool Air and retelling that in a way that was completely, it's like an inversion. and this is often what Moore does, is he takes the story that's in a story by Lovecraft, and then he inverts it. So, for example, in the first issue of Providence, I don't even know what the title is of that particular, each chapter has its own title, right? Oh, it's The Yellow Sign, right? Mm-hmm. And right. So it includes, of course, the exit garden, as he's called it in other works. Maybe that's what it's called here as well, which is a suicide booth, right? And that suicide booth is not from Lovecraft, but it's from the predecessor.
That's
right.
Robert
Chambers. Exactly. And that story, that the Repair of Reputations, where we mm-hmm. see it, is it's that's sort of the overarching plot of the story as well, right? Of the story of Providence, and even stretching back now that I look at it, into the courtyard and Neonomicon. That, I mean, I don't know if he planned it out that way or it ended up being that way, but when we get to Cool Air, the Cool Air part of the story, where we have this Spanish doctor and his housemaid, no, not housemaid, she's the landlady, right?
Housekeeper.
The housekeeper, yeah, right? So yeah. If you read Cool Air, she's sort of just a figure to get us to the doctor. But what Moore does is he turns her into a figure of love. Instead of being a story about feeling fear in the bright daylight of New York City on a hot summer's day, it's a story about love enduring after death. Right? This woman is in love and having sex with a corpse. That is not what Lovecraft was going for. He's inverting it, right? He's turning it into a romance, which is hilarious, but also deeply profound. Like, I was, oh my God, that's what I loved about Neonomicon and what I love about Providence, is you just turn the page and you cannot believe what's on that next page.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When we get deep into the series, I had that experience probably with every issue. There was something on the next page, and I'm like, I can't believe this is in a comic, but not just because it's shocking to look at, but because it's so profoundly moving in some certain way, if you know what I mean. So that's mm-hmm. what I thought about it as a starter.
No, I do. I do. A couple other things. One of the unique gimmicks that he used in this series was that every issue, with the exception of the last two, had a lot of back matter. Each had 10 to 12 pages of Robert Black's handwritten diary from his common book, which becomes almost a MacGuffin during the course of the last act of the series. And it's interesting because that, the deeper into the series you got, the more and more the commonplace book contents became integral to the plot. Right. He talks about dreams he has. He talks about things that happen off camera. He talks about incidentals in his life, which turn out to be not so incidental. He sort of basically at one point tells us the entire ending of the series without us knowing it, and gives us much more insight into Black's mind, because Black is a character who, as I said, doesn't see what's happening around him, but he's fascinated by fiction and he's fascinated by literary tropes, and he actually, it's almost as if he's subconsciously self-aware of what's happening to him, even though he's sort of in this perpetual state of denial. Mm-hmm. The thing for me also was that in playing around with the Lovecraftian universe, it had almost a very new, weird feel to it, because of the fact that he never, with a few exceptions where something really shocking happens, he kept it all. A character walks into a room where something nightmarish is going on, and he doesn't realize how nightmarish it is. When he goes to Salem and meets the old men in Salem, when he walks into when he first arrives in Providence and he meets the doctor who's looking at him through the purple glasses and seeing all the wrigglies in the air around him and stuff like that. He's quite literally in the midst of these horrors and not only aware of it, aware of what the significance of what he can see that's going on around him, but also unaware of the significance of what his journey is bringing him towards. Something else is that this is one of the few actual portrayals of Lovecraft in a comic.
As Lovecraft, as opposed to some other figure that they're saying is Lovecraft, right?
Right.
It's actually
right.
him, mm-hmm. rather than yeah. some yes. guy with that name who's a detective or something.
Yeah. And his family and his idiosyncratic way of talking. We learn a bit of the family history as well. But, I mean, there's been a few cases where we've seen Lovecraft as Lovecraft. He made a cameo in the Planetary Authority crossover. I remember that.
But he's doing real, like, things he did in his own life, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And some of that I really appreciated, for example, where they meet up with Lord Dunsany. Mm-hmm. Because that's a pretty obscure meeting. But, yes. you know, Dunsany had such a big influence on his writing and many other people's writing. So it's nice to be like, you know, all the crossovers.
No, that's...
And if you don't know about the people he was involved with, you might miss some of these things. For example, was it the last issue where they have the panel by panel? You're going through history. You have one panel where you see the...
issue 11,
The plight of Robert E. Howard.
Yep.
Well, you might not know that was Robert E. Howard in that car doing what was going on in that car, mm-hmm. to avoid the spoiler for those that may not know what is involved. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh my God, they're tying everybody into this.
And every other story that's not done proper, right, is of Lovecraft's. It has a panel in some of the sequences where he jumps, you know, the dialogue is from the conversation they're having, but the imagery is from specific stories that don't have their own special issue.
Right. Well, that was what, you know, we see all of the characters that we've met in the series. We sort of see what happens to them as Lovecraft described it. But also in issue 11, we get a very encapsulated history of Lovecraft fandom.
Mm-hmm. And a commentary on it as well.
Hell yeah. That was one of the more fascinating parts. And that's why reading issue 11, it almost had a surrealist feel to it. Mm-hmm. As we see how these little schisms and arguments in the wake of Lovecraft's death led to all of the very scholarly and not so scholarly things that happened regarding his work in the
S.D. Joshi in the last issue. I mean, every word he said sounded exactly like S.D. Joshi.
Yeah.
You could hear his voice literally saying those words and reacting in that way. He's modeled him perfectly.
Yes. So clearly this is a book with a lot of research, and there's always stuff to be gleaned in rereads. And I highly recommend the annotation page. But I want to talk about issue 11 again rather quickly, because he's showing us not only the aftermath of the events of the characters he created, that more created for the various stories. He is also showing us, as I said, the history of fandom and kind of the literary influence that rippled down in the wake of Lovecraft. And is also showing us this little history of what happened to all of his characters. So not only is the characters that Black wrote about, that Lovecraft was inspired to write about, we see what happens to them, and we also see what happens to the fiction that he wrote about it. So we get kind of very metatextual in an obvious way. And he's not trying to hide this. He's doing this out front. There is one panel in issue 11 where you see all the plush Cthulhu toys sitting on the bookshelf. And, you know, Moore had said before this series started that the reason he wanted to write it was that he felt that everybody had become far too comfortable with the Cthulhu mythos. I thought that was interesting, because I hate when they turn anything nightmarish into a cute plushy thing anyway.
Well, there is a natural reaction to that. You know, the reason I like to think, I don't have any actual skulls sitting on my desk, but the reason I like Halloween sort of garb that's actually, you know, not superheroes dressed up as superheroes, but like, you know, a skull or ghost or whatever, is because it's embracing the idea of not looking away from death. And Cthulhu can be like that, right? But if you've never read the stories, then it's just another something, it's so far removed, right? And that's real. Notice that in that picture, in that panel, in issue 11, it's all Cthulhu. Like, there's no other creature on that shelf, right? There's no other monster or idea. And I think that's the real ridiculousness. The highest heights that this goes to is not with the Cthulhu at all. It's with the Dreamlands, in my book.
Yeah.
What he does in the Dreamlands issues, or the Unknown Kadath issue, it just blew my mind. I just, like, of course that's what it is, right? Moore is seeing stuff that's in the text that Lovecraft doesn't even know is there.
Mm-hmm.
That is there. That's amazing. And I think Moore's attack on, or at least critique of the fanish, let's turn it into a commercial product. And right. This is absolutely not a commercial product for the mainstream, right? Which is, it's amazing that it could, I was surprised that every issue would come out, because you have to be so deep into the Lovecraft to really appreciate what's going on here. It looks pretty and all, but if you don't know, you know, haven't read very closely the thing on the doorstep, you're not going to get what's going on in that issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I barely got it, and I was deep into it. So,
and I'm amazed by what I saw. That was another case of him revisiting something he's done in the past, because the whole body swap was something he had done in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Century. I think the second issue of that, he sort of did it in a very similar manner to how he did it in Manchester.
He doesn't shy away from, you're talking Moore, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't shy away from another theme that he revisits often, which is rape, right? Happens in Providence, happens in Neonomicon. I believe it happens in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Is it that he's obsessed with rape? I don't think so. I think it's that it's, you know, a lot of what power is power in every direction. And that includes sexuality. And that's not nice to think about, but I like that Alan Moore is this force of nature out there doing weird things and saying weird stuff and taking the heat that almost no writer of comics ever has.
Right. And there's like, even
Garth Ennis doesn't go there, right?
Yeah, there was an interview where somebody sort of pressed him, put his feet to the flames about that, and he made a comment along the lines of, there are far more rapes than murders in the world.
Of course.
And we have no problem with murder as a plot point, but
no.
he decided to embrace that in some very strange and weird ways in the course
of this. It's just look at it, right? He's not even like saying, well, this is awesome, right? It's like, look at, when you turn that page and you realize what's going on, oh dear God, right?
Yep.
This is straight out of the story, right? This is the stuff that Lovecraft doesn't talk about, but is in the story, right? Things that are happening off screen in Lovecraft's stories, he puts on the screen and says, look at that. Now what do you think? And I'm like, Jesus, okay. Wow.
There was a couple things that never get addressed or never get resolutions, such as the fact that Black sort of goes on this because of the fact that his lover, we should also mention, we've totally forgotten, Black is both Jewish and gay and in the closet about both of those things. And his lover has committed suicide in one of the Robert Chamber suicide rooms. And that's sort of one of the things that becomes part of his motivation. The doctor, the cool air doctor in the first, I think Alvarez, they call him in this.
Mm-hmm.
Actually says to him something to the effect of, you know, we are all set on our path by actions. And going back and reading the annotations on Facts in the Case of, it's, Alex Kay really takes that apart and shows, you know, really analyzes everything the doctor says to Black in that thing, and sort of shows him that he's basically telling him, yeah, you're about to go on a journey you're not going to enjoy. And the other thing was in issue 3, I believe, when he goes to Salem, we are treated to a prolonged dream sequence, which is basically sort of prophesizing World War II and the rise of the Third Reich to an extent where someone could almost say that it's being a bit heavy-handed, because it is. It's almost like this weird surrealist burlesque version of the rise of the Third Reich and everything that happens. And I really expected, given how unusual that entire sequence was, I really thought it was going to be revisited, and I thought he was going to talk about basically how World War II fit into this whole thing, because it all, he almost made it sound as if World War II had the potential to be the thing that would prevent the horrors from occurring, the way he portrayed it to us, the fact that all of these fascist forces are basically attempting to undo the work of the group, the Stella Sapiens, and the various families and characters that you've seen in here. And I thought that was a weird little statement to make, and I was almost a little concerned that he was going to try to go that route, because I was going to go, that's a, you better pull that off right, or else you're going to be dragged through the mud for it.
Well, the people that are in that sequence, though, are not, I mean, they're like the people that are in Arkham and stuff, which kind of does loop back into the story where J. Edgar Hoover and company raid Innsmouth and, you know, round up the Deep Ones and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's American fascism, right?
Right, right, exactly. Not necessarily the overseas version.
Right, and once again, poor Robert Block, he's the cause of that, because it wouldn't have happened without his Commonplace book. Yep. None of that would have occurred. Yeah, Robert's almost. Sometimes you're shaking your head at him, and sometimes you feel so bad for him. So let's address that. Robert going into the chamber at the end. After coming out to his coworker that he's gay.
This is in issue 11, right?
Is issue 11, yes. Interspersed with all of the history lessons that we get. He comes home. He's already sent his Commonplace book off to Tom Malone, hoping that he'll be able to find a way to bring everything to an end or derail it. But at the same time, he's almost kind of accepting of what's happened to him. And he sort of realizes that he was not a fool, but certainly not as cognizant as he should have been of what was going on around him. I got to admit, I was really unclear what was going to happen to Robert in this issue. I mean, he Johnny Carcosa basically tells him, "Oh, you're our savior. You've brought all this about," and then basically sends him packing to sit around and be depressed in New York City until he decides to go on off himself. And he's sort of left empty. And something kind of similar happens to Breers in issue 12, where she basically says, "Well, I guess that's it. Cthulhu's never going to remember me. This is the extent of my reward. Now I just get to wander around." Which sort of mirrors the, you know, cold, indifferent cosmos that Lovecraft insisted we all dwell in. But at the same time, you know, Black embraces his end. And I was really, really touched by that. I hadn't felt sad for a comic character's demise in quite a while. And Black's certainly did. He got nothing out of it except for a quick servicing from Carcosa in the attic.
It's a symmetry that you find in really good writing, right?
Oh, yeah.
It starts with that and it ends with that, and you don't see it coming, but it's completely logical. One of the things that I noticed while I was... I don't normally do floppies. I've been doing floppies since this came out because I have to go and make sure I get, you know, the only or whatever issue they would have at the store. And so I've been going there. But one thing I noticed as I'm reading it through floppies instead of, you know, in the trades, is that I was seeing patterns issue after issue. And I thought, geez, this Jason Burroughs guy, he really has a thing for hands and heads. Like, almost every panel that has a human figure in it, which is almost every panel, has hands prominently displayed and heads often not, you know, facing you. Or if they are, they're somehow prominently displayed. And I didn't get what that was a reference to consciously until, of course, going back to the very beginning, which is not with the first issue of Providence, but rather with the courtyard. And that goes all the way back to the Fungi from Yugoth poem, the sonnet, that has, you know, neither hands nor heads, these dancing figures, right? Once you read the verses, once you learn Aklo, this is where you go. And, of course, this is right in that first issue when we see the flashbacks of Robert's lover. The things that give her away, right, is her hands. They're too big. They're mannish, right? You're looking at it, that's a woman. She has really big hands. Oh, and an Adam's apple, right? And it all comes together, logically flowing, seeing those hands and heads sort of prominently displayed in every panel. Usually artists try and hide the hands, you know, because they're hard to draw. Try not to do it too much. But here they're emphasized because of that visual image that comes again and again and again. And there's so much that's not in the text, right? That's just in the placement of the imagery, seeing that spinning disc in issue 11. We know where we are now. That's right back in issue 1.
Yeah. Well, he gave us, you know, that was one of the things I did like about issue 12, was that he gave us all of these assorted callbacks to various characters we had met in those previous two series. The kid with the guitar, mm-hmm. who's playing to a bunch of heads and hands. And then we actually do see the bodies dancing, which was a lovely little callback that I wasn't expecting. And then showing us, you know, the Dreamlands kind of opening up and giving that, I mean, that entire sequence, that whole walk to the bridge is just such a masterful little bit of, you know, walking out of the school and seeing the car being consumed by the grass and running into Ainsley and Orne and the way they mirror image each other, walking the characters off panel to their demises. And it was all done just so. And also sort of getting that little history bit. And that's one other thing. God, I got to go back to people not getting their rewards is when the small black child who turns out to be who's basically the character from Thing on the Doorstep sort of gives a brief history of what happened to all the characters we met over the course of Providence. And it didn't turn out too well for them either. So this was all pretty much a bad deal for everybody, with the exception of Cthulhu and the Dreamlands as well.
But it echoes the history of it, right? And we get that in issue 11 with Barlow getting his reputation besmirched by August Derleth, right?
Yep.
Says, you know, he's a hog trying to steal, and everything he accuses Barlow of is everything he's doing. And of course, sullying the work as well by claiming that this is written by Lovecraft. It ain't written by Lovecraft. People give him credit, right? For, oh, he revived it. Well, I think Barlow might have been able to do it too if he wasn't, you know, who knows? But yeah, it's basically a story of injustice, right? History is a story of injustice over and over and over again. But Clark Ashton Smith, you know, I've been delving into his story over the last, you know, during just this time of reading Providence from 2015 to now. And, you know, he was feted like no other person I've ever seen in any newspaper who was an artist. Like, I found the same headline in the same article about him in every newspaper the year he was, you know, showcased. It says this genius, boy genius out of the desert of California, raised without, you know, and it was in every newspaper in North America. And then he, how's he end? You know, a horrible ending with people saying, yeah, that goofy fag professor died of taking goofballs, right? Oh, fuck, that's horrible. That's no way to, that's not your reputation, right? And the one with the suicide of I mean, it's deeply about suicide, right? This whole series, it's the suicide of Robert E. Howard. When it's reported in the papers, is he wrote cowboy stories, right?
Yep.
Yeah, technically true, but that's not the story, right? So what I do appreciate about this is, you know, when we see Borges in the panel, and it doesn't say, you know, this is Borges, right? You just know, oh, that's Borges, right? That is the justice that comes with really good writing. It's not commercial. I mean, it seems to be doing well with the Kickstarter for, you know, the new volumes or whatever, but this is not done out of, you know, commercial interest as much as it's done out of a deep reverence and argument with material.
Oh, yeah. It struck me almost as if the whole idea that there was this other layer of meaning that Moore saw in Lovecraft, and quite frankly, Joshi, for that, you know, a lot of themes that Joshi has talked about are brought up in over the course of the story, especially in the commonplace book entries. That Moore saw that there was this other layer that was there, and that the indifference that Lovecraft embraced, I think he thought he really didn't consider the ramifications of it. He didn't consider what baggage that would carry with it. The whole idea that if this is the way the universe was working, and if there was this level of prophecy and dream agency and stuff like that occurring around us, that, you know, wherein so many Lovecraft stories tend to end with, yeah, something might blow up or collapse, but, you know, the world continues to go on, wherein in here he sort of makes it plainly clear that no, it wouldn't, you know, not in any way, not in any, you know, way, not in any way that would matter, especially when you look at the style and the tone of a lot of the Lovecraft stories playing off the way they did with expectations.
I mentioned to you guys my post about the first issue of Providence. I didn't actually say I just did a bunch of circling and I didn't say what this analysis means. I don't know. I must have said it on my podcast at some point, not, but I want to point your attention to it. Just, this is like I assume this is in every issue. Right? I just noticed this one little thing and I said, oh, that's weird. I wonder what it means. I'll follow it along. And I got really deep into it doing the research. And I'm like, this is why Alan Moore is, you know, he's got a guy writing a book about what he wrote a book of, right? his annotations are always incredible. The annotations for his stuff, because he's just so knowledgeable and he puts so much into it. So in the very, very first panel, it doesn't have this butterfly, right? This is the final image of issue 12 with the tearing up of the document as well, right? So we got that symmetry, but there's a tiny little building sign that says P-E-R-I-S. Paris or something like that. So that's weird. And then I notice, because I'm scanning it, assuming it's Alan Moore, I think, okay, that's a word. I'll look it up. It didn't mean anything at me. I follow the butterfly backwards, starting with the moth backwards, and see where it goes, where it leads, what happens, right? It ends up on page 19 of the first issue, in the fourth panel, dead on the ground, after Robert Black's lovers walked in, and of course Robert Black himself, who looks exactly, these guys look exactly the same. You can't see in those images, it looks like the same guy, right? So it could be Robert Black, except for the fact that it's not winter, which is when he does it, right? Mm-hmm. It also looks like Lovecraft, does it not, from the back with the suit and the haircut, right? Okay, so it's representing something. The butterfly goes in, goes away as the man goes in, and then is dead. Tracking it backwards, wherever he goes, it follows, just like those leaves that are the leaves, as in the pages from the document he's just shredded and thrown in the water. Well, it turns out that P-E-R-I-S isn't really a product, like the sign says. It is and I figured maybe this out in the first issue, but it was confirmed in the second issue. The final issue, or the second final panel of the second issue, has a man, a young man with a scar on his face and a feather in his hand, and they're
peacock feathers.
Peacock in front of Sedan's feathers, church. Exactly, right. Yes. So it's telling us, you know, this is a Asian, you know, god reference, right? An older god, in a certain sense. There is a, I can't remember the name of the god that has these peacock feathers associated with it, but this is Perry is a demon, once a demon that became an angel, or a demon that was demonic but turned out not to be. So in the ancient times, people thought, oh, it's evil, but actually turned out to be good, right? This is like the relationship between homosexuality in the 1919s, when we think, oh, that's terrible, right? You're not only a criminal, you need to be in a mental institution. And of course, that's not what we think today. They're just human beings, and the punishment that is meted out to them unjustly is transformative. It's also symbolized by this butterfly, the transformation. But of course, the moth is also Lovecraft, right? He's the one who's out at night with his telescope, taking his night walks, right? He came alive at night, like a lot of homosexuality. Homosexuals, they couldn't tell people what they really were. So this metaphor that is just hiding in the background in the panel of the first issue is throughout all the issues, I'm sure. Not this particular metaphor, but metaphors like this, visual metaphors that you can't see unless you're, you know, treating it seriously and reading it deeply and, you know, sort of saying, yeah, this is Alan Moore, pay attention. Everything means something. It's not there for decoration only. Sure, it's beautiful too, but that just blew me away.
Oh, there are lots and lots of little, like the fact that every issue has a black cat in it somewhere. Mm.
And the white cat too.
The white cats, yeah. And when he's talking to, just before he goes into the Dreamlands, the cat basically walks up to the camera and looks right at us while they're discussing the nature of dreams.
Was it issue 8 that is the Dreamlands issue?
Yes, issue 8, which is probably my favorite issue when it comes to Jason Barrow's art.
It's amazing, right? It's just amazing. That the thing is he is mapping the story and seeing something that's there. Right. So this is Alan Moore, right? He kind of dances with sexuality all the time. So there's a tower in the story, the novel, right? But I didn't make any connection. Oh yeah, it's a penis, right? Of course I didn't make that connection. I'm thinking like Lovecraft, right? But then, oh yeah, suddenly all these white cats shoot out of the top of the tower and fly up into the sky. Going to what? The moon, a giant egg in the sky. Okay. Robert Black is just going with it, right? Like, we are going with it when we read Dream's Quest of Unknown Kadath. But, or, you know, his bent is a different way, and he sees it as dream symbology in a, you know, Jungian or maybe Freudian sense, right? There's a lot of that going on, and that inversion of the expected imagery is stunning. It's just there's nothing like it. And unless you're super familiar with like Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, you're not going to get any of that. You just get what the hell's going on.
Yeah, there's so many great little off panels in there where we're seeing the you know, scenes from stories or the actions being illustrated that we're not aware of. And another, you know, really good moment is when Black actually meets Lovecraft for the first time, and we see those single panels of all the characters that he's come across so far, sort of realizing that the prophecy is being fulfilled. I thought that was such a amazingly effective bit of panel work. But yeah, he's known for the old legend used to be at the time of Watchmen that every panel basically came out to a page of description that he would hand to the artist.
And you know, it's not when Jason Burroughs does that, you know, that what's the name of that building in the first issue with the owls, right? Those owls were really there. Yeah. The glowing eyes, and that newspaper building really looked like that, right?
Yeah.
And connecting it, the whole of the both Neonomicon and Courtyard and Providence together, one of the reasons that World War II doesn't, I think, probably come up is because right in that very first Courtyard two-issue series is that it's not our world, right? It's right. Like our world, but the telephone booth isn't just a telephone booth. It's a fax booth,
right?
And it's Farrakhan Day, right? It's not Martin Luther King Day. So whatever's going on, it's a variant of our world. Our world appears in Providence, right? I think. Pretty sure those plush Cthulhu panels are from our world. Robert E. Howard shooting himself panel is from our world. But not the majority of their world is... It's a deviant history, just like going right back to the Repairer of Reputations, where it appears like our world. If you're not super familiar with American history, you know, they don't have those. They don't have military units like that, and they don't actually have exit or whatever they're called. They're not called exit gardens. They're not called suicide booths. But whatever they're called, they're not that. Right? They didn't exist in New York at that time, and still don't. Although they're in Futurama, right? Yeah. New York will have them. So there's a depth of difference that it only comes with an expertise like Moore.
Well, you can see some places where it's split.
Mm-hmm.
Because like the episode where he visits the farm, that's basically the color out of space. You've got the one FBI agent, he's talking about putting domes over cities to protect us from this invasive species. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, you see that. That explains the domes you see in the Courtyard. And then again later on in episode 11 and stuff like that, where everything starts to shift. So, you know, there's reality. Things loop back on itself. Changes the universe. It splits into a different path. I mean, between 11 and 12, that's really where it starts to split.
Yep.
Because reality completely shifts. You know, from that one panel from the left to the right, as they're passing in front of the one dome, it changes from, you know, it's kind of got this black superstructure, but by the time you get over to the right side, it's like covered with the fantastic, you know, Yithian fungus or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're totally out of the universe.
That was something else that Barrow did really well with... when it came to, you know, subtleties and the changes of setting, especially in issue 5, where they're walking through what's effectively the witch house from Dreams of the Witch House. And every time you see a chair, it's got a different number of braces on its back, or the mouse hole will move on the wall, or the ratio of the room will be different. Or even when you first see the actual house, it geometrically doesn't actually make sense. There's a window sticking out where it shouldn't be able to, and there's definitely a corner missing, and perspective doesn't quite line up. And of course, when we turn the page and we see it and we go, oh, we're gonna be visiting the house from Dreams in the Witch House, and then slowly but surely we realize the role that it plays in the course of the story. So
let me ask, who were James and what was the other guy? Was it Hector? Yeah, James and Hector, the two professors that he runs into that they put him up for the night.
Was it
Reanimator?
Yeah, Reanimator.
All right, because there was the hint about, I apologize for the smell of formaldehyde and stuff, but it was never clear.
Yeah, he's trying to get
it. And then let me ask another hypothetical. Who do you think was in the brain case in episode 12?
Oh, that's Ambrose Bierce.
Was it? Okay.
Because he says, he says he's the son of Marcus Aurelius, which was Ambrose Bierce's father's name.
I didn't get that.
That's,
because I was wondering whether it was possibly black.
Yeah, I thought so as well when he talked about being a reporter, but Black had been told in issue 11 that Bierce is with us now. You know, Carcosa tells him basically that.
Right.
No, I thought Bierce
didn't die, right? He just disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, because he worked for the Herald, you know, the newspaper, and he was the Herald. So I figured since he was the Herald of the whole age that he would be there at the end in some way. And coming back as a brain case would have been appropriate.
No, I agree, and I actually thought that for a bit, and then something about the way the language was, the fact that he was so, you know, coming out and saying, "Yeah, look, I'm not deaf," being as forward as he was, I really didn't think that was supposed to have been black. Mm-hmm. The fact that they tied Bierce into it was quite nice, given how prominent Carcosa is.
Which issue was the one with the Dunwich Horror? Is that 4? Something in there?
Well, it shows up in 11 again. That's where it kind of ends up. But
4 was when he visits the farm.
Yeah, 4.
Okay.
Right.
So I thought that that was a reading. Like, when I read the Dunwich Horror, I did it for my podcast. I was like, yeah, these are the heroes. And they're not the villains. They're victims. Right, they're not the, you know, like seeing the picture of the Dunwich boys together on a couch, right, when they're young. You see the guy, you know, hugging his brother, right, his invisible brother, and you say, oh, that's like lovely, right? It's a family photo. That's amazing that
right
Moore inverts.
Once again, the fact that Moore's taken that and turned it into a separate attempt to bring about the Redeemer prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that all the callbacks, you know, you talk about the invisible brother in the picture and the fact that the first page of that is basically from the invisible brother's point of view, mm-hmm. and the mother coming up and hugging him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that Black can't see anything of what's going on.
Yeah, he's incredibly dense, right?
Right.
Every time he's oblivious, even in his own writings, he's telling us information that he doesn't know that we know he has witnessed.
Right. But he maintains that when you get to issue 11 and Black gets on the bus, you see one brother sitting at the window of the bus, but the seat next to him is empty.
Right.
Yep. And then when you actually
everybody's on that train.
Right. And when and then later on when you get to the panel that shows you what happened in Dunwich Horror, you see the powder's been thrown on the shape. And if you look, the shape has the face of the old man. It's actually sort of hinted in there in the powder laying on there. So when he picks a good gimmick, he sticks with it, you know.
Speaking of powder, that goes right back. I was rereading Courtyard, right? I haven't read it since it came out in 2011 in the trade paperback. Do you think, before I get into that, do you think that the Courtyard was, that they knew that there was going to be Neonomicon after? Does anybody know? Because
I don't think so, because Courtyard was a short story before it was
Well, it was separated by years, right? But there's a thing that happens in the courtyard. They look at the he looks at the wall outside the courtyard with the basically a picture of the King in Yellow on it, right? And then that doesn't pay off in the first two issues.
King in Yellow or Ugalinuk?
Well, so somebody dressed in yellow, right? Some being, he says, I hope it's a tree. I took it as the King in Yellow, but you're probably right. It is multiple meanings. And then I noticed also in the courtyard, this is amazing, right? The courtyard cover art in one of the volumes for volume 2, one of the many multiple covers, right, is actually the first issue of Providence as well, with the tree in the foreground. I mean, it's not the same building. It's not the same tree, but it's the same image with a tree in the foreground shadowing a tenement, right? And And that's like, oh yeah, and that's a real building, of course, in the in New York, that's, you know, actually referenced, and it's very cool and all. But like the depth of callbacks it's almost like it's all planned and it all flowed from the beginning. So I assume that he's just, you know, making sure he's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I would say it is probably better as an individual issue dealing with everything. I was not super enthused with the final issue. I mean, I see it's inevitable in that, but just him taking on the individual stories was just amazing after amazing. Every time he tackled a new story, I was like, oh yeah, he's seeing things there that are there that I didn't see. He's helping me read Lovecraft in a certain way. And not that that's the only way to read it, but in a new way, right?
Right. No, I completely agree.
I was going to say the white powder. So that powder that we see the invisible brother with, right? That goes back to the courtyard with what he says is, you know, it's a weak, what he called it, a weak hallucinogen, right?
Yeah.
Well, the powder in the courtyard is, I thought, from Arthur Machen.
Right. So it's called the novel The White Powder, right? So I'm thinking, right. That's right.
But the powder in the Dunwich Horror end, that is mentioned in the story, the Dunwich Horror, as something that they spray in order to make Wilbur's older brother or bigger brother appear.
Right.
And I don't think they call it Aklo in that.
But the powder isn't Aklo, right? That's the thing, right? Is it in the courtyard? We think it's Aklo because he's going to go buy some drugs.
Right.
Well, DMT, what it really is, right? I didn't know that at the time, but DMT is a real drug, and it's something that's inside of us naturally. But when you take it, it sort of bumps up your levels like an opiate does, right? It takes you in a different place, and that's the same drug, or the same active ingredient as is in ayahuasca, the very popular sort of come to a new understanding of your reality drug.
It's so funny that you bring that up, because when Robert gets to Manchester and sits down to read the book, and we have these lovely panels showing that time is passing without his knowledge, mm-hmm. I kept waiting for him to have that experience that Aldo Sachs had, mm-hmm. where his mind just kind of pops, you know. And it was one of those things where it was almost like the other shoe to fall. You were waiting for this revelation to hit Black over the course of the story. And when it does, it hits from a completely different direction. It's basically being shown a picture of Lovecraft's grandfather, and suddenly he puts it all together. But yeah, I kind of expected some of the real pyrotechnics that, you know, that Moore did in Courtyard in order to really, you know, hammer it home. And who was Carcosa's mother?
She shows up.
She's a deep one,
right?
Yeah. Or a hybrid.
Yeah. Well, they're the same thing, though, right? Ultimately, right? You eventually become a deep one, right? You start off with your land legs, and you end up with your sea legs, right?
Yeah.
Well, the deep ones were a separate race when they interbred. Those were the ones that would the people that would eventually revert.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow, now the mother, if I remember, I mean, she like even shows up. There's that one sequence, I think it's like back in the past, where you have the women on either side of the walkway.
Mm-hmm.
And she's walking down. I think that was her in there. I mean, yeah, she's all over the place.
What sequence was that?
It was pretty late in the, like, 10 or 9 or 10.
Well, I know she's at the church in 10. She's leading the women at the church.
Right, that's the one
I'm
thinking of.
That's the church where they know that Carcosa's going to come out of. That's the church that invades Robert's room. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's based on an actual church in Providence that formed the basis for The Haunter of the Dark that Lovecraft wrote where he kills off Robert Bloch after Robert Bloch kills him off in his first story. Mm-hmm. And then Bloch revisits it a third time. I forget what the third story is that he wrote maybe a couple decades later, where Nyarlathotep shows up. And the escaped panthers or something from the zoo come and lick his hands.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's that little trilogy of the three stories.
Yeah.
I mean, that was great, that whole thing with the Haunter of the Dark, you know, the him and that guy exploring the church. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, there's the Shining Trapezoid, and there's that. There's
and that being the stone that came down out of the sky from
right.
Color Out of Space, combining all that.
I mean, the number of literary jokes are astounding, and it's always hilarious when you make that link. It's like, you know, the secret cult is really the Starry Wisdom sect, and you know the book is the Necronomicon, and you know, Lovecraft's like, oh, I like that name, but I have a better one that I had, you know, made up as a kid. You know, when I used to pretend I was an Arab. You know, Abdul Hazard, I'll use that instead. You know, like, you know, all the jokes. I always laughed. When I read that.
What I like also is that it doesn't even though it is playing with the, you know, where did this story get inspired by, we don't come away with the idea that, like, a lot of people that they go that direction. I've read a lot of Lovecraft comics and, you know, this strange blank of H.P. Lovecraft or whatever, and it's like, no, he doesn't really believe in this stuff. We never get the sense that Lovecraft himself is stuck in the things that Robert Bloch is stuck in, right? They're parallel stories in a certain sense. And there's a dignity shown here that we don't see, I think, in a lot of other material. It isn't all Cthulhu all the time.
Yeah.
And squiggles. And I mean, yeah, they'll put that on the cover to sell a couple of issues, right? But it's the final quote is from Beyond the Wall of Sleep, which is not a famous story in the greatest sense, right? It's an appropriate line, and he always goes the most effective rather than the most commercial, and yeah, it makes it better.
That was something that went right before we got into, right before he actually gets to Providence, he meets Pickman and he meets Randall Carter, who's supposed to be Randolph Carter. Mm-hmm. And it's Randall who gets him involved in the Dreamlands and talks to him about, you know, it does a very good encapsulated history of where pulp fiction was at the time. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was not considered respectable, but it did breed quite a bit of imaginative work. And the fact that this is happening right after everything that's gone on in Manchester. But both Pickman and Carver, I was reading these stories wondering how complicit they were in everything, because I don't think either of them really referenced Bloch as the Herald, which most of the other characters do. And it made me wonder if Carver's role in this conspiracy was to introduce him to Lovecraft, or if, you know, if
even teach him the lucid dream. I mean,
right. You know, it was, methods. Yeah, to me, it was basically Bloch was part of the prophecy, but he never explicitly says in those issues if Pickman and Carver are in on it. Pickman actually goes so far as to say, well, what you're saying is interesting, but I really don't understand any of it. So,
I mean, he's there to both, like, verify the whole thing which happened in under Saddam's church,
yeah,
by showing the underworld, but also hooking him up with the ghouls,
right,
who have a certain amount of secret knowledge. And Carver is to introduce him to lucid dreaming, which kind of opens up the whole thing with the journal further.
Right.
I mean, before that, it was pretty, I mean, he's got some story ideas and stuff, but it's, you know, more a day book, you know, what happened today. And then things really go wild with the dreams and you know, the illusions and stuff.
Yeah, I actually went back and reread that entry from the comic book, and I sort of said, wow, he really does give away the entire ending of the story here without
Yeah, I had people on Twitter saying, you know, specifically, Jesse, what can issue 12 be about? And I'm like, I have no idea, because we're done in issue 11, right? It's done.
Well, that's a very quiet apocalypse.
Yeah, it's over, and then we get it ties it all back together.
You know, that was the other thing. I was very out of the few things that really disappointed me. I was disappointed that Aldo didn't get a moment with Carcosa. As soon as Carcosa shows up, he basically gets walked off camera to be killed. And given the fact that it was Carcosa that sent him on his way, at least have him fall to his knees or something, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if we're going to take what happens to Aldo in Courtyard as being sort of the opening salvo in this sequence, then, you know, him and Carcosa, it's kind of a big deal. Plus, he helps in his own small way bring about all this other stuff, and he doesn't seem to get a reward for it. So,
yeah. Some of those rewards were not.
No, they were. No, they weren't. They weren't. And the fact that he kept justice. Going. Well, not. I think the fact that everybody goes so far as to say what a big deal the Herald is and how great the rewards will be. And we will make sure everybody is, you know, will know our gratitude and the fact that nobody really gets anything out of it. You know, he hits that theme over and over again. So.
Yeah. And I think part of what Moore does with this is very similar to a lot of the other stuff that I've been reading lately. I mean, I don't know, Jesse, if you read Ballad of Black Tom.
Mm-mm.
Or the Dream Quest of Valet Bode, no. Or Agents of Dreamland. No. I mean, it's especially under tour books, there's all this revamping or reimagining of Lovecraft going on. Mm-hmm. And some of this stuff is fantastic. I mean, the Ballad of Black Tom is a retelling of the horror of Red Hook.
Hmm.
From the viewpoint of somebody who helps the horror along, basically. And you've got, I mean, all the same people are there. You've got the policeman there, and Saddam's there. Everybody's there, but it's told again from a totally different angle. And Dream Quest of Valet Bode is it Keyes Johnson, mm-hmm. and she does a sequel of the Dream Quest, and you return to the Dreamlands, and it's like you've got this whole industry going around of helping dreamers on their quests, and. You know, the Dreamlands have advanced in technology a little bit, and the universities have grown up, and, you know, you've got dreamers coming in and staying for a while and interfering and disappearing, and Carter is there again, you know, much older, and I'm not sure. I know Ballad of Black Tom is up right now for both the Nebula and the Hugo. I think Dream Quest also was nominated for one of them, so it's just interesting to read all these reimaginings of Lovecraft, because you've got, on the one hand, you've got people like, speaking of a character in issue 12, you've got Joshi, who's like, you know, just gone in some ways off the deep end with his defense of, yeah. Oh, you can't change the statue for the World Fantasy Convention. It's got to be this, and you're insulting Lovecraft or whatever. But then you've got all these other people on the other end taking Lovecraft and just turning him on his head or looking at him from the other way, just similar to what Moore has done. But it's just amazing this whole industry sprung up with this reworking of this guy.
Yeah, well, there was that, now I got to look it up. Hold on. There was one anthology.
I would say change this, while you're doing that, I would just say change the statue for the World Fantasy Award to a better looking statue, because it's not a great looking statue. I think it should still be Lovecraft, just a better bust. It's not great. It's not terrible, but it's not great.
That's Gain Wilson. I mean, yeah, I like Gain Wilson, but
it's not my favorite.
Not as a statue.
But
it's hilarious. All these changes.
There was an anthology that
Lovecraft's Monsters
the one that really tries to tackle what you're talking about, Fred.
Well, there was one that was, I think, all women writers. And I think Ellen Datlow's done a couple.
Children of? It might have been hers. Let me see.
Yeah, that was one. That was right. Yep.
No, it was the, was it, oh, was it Paula Gurian's book? I got to see the table of contents. Hold on. This is the exciting audio of me opening up files to make sure I know what I'm talking about.
It was happening at the time, though. Like, when I just did a story called Far Below by Robert Barber Johnson, which is from 1938, mm-hmm. you know, a year or so after Lovecraft's dead. And it explicitly mentions Lovecraft, and it's his story inspired by Pickman's model, right? And it's like, basically, if you read the letters columns of Weird Tales, it's everybody saying, more Lovecraft, more Howard. Oh, and some people like the...
More Smith.
Yeah, they always mention Smith too, but there's the Jules de Grandin. I love that series. But it was consistently Lovecraft, Lovecraft, Lovecraft. And that's the other writers too saying more Lovecraft, and they're sending in their Lovecraftian stories. So the expansion, it's like it died with Weird Tales in a certain sense. And then there was the books, and we're supposed to thank August Derleth for that, I guess. I would say the game did a lot more for it than August Derleth.
Well, even before the game, I mean, you had like Lynn Carter, with the Ballantine Adult Fantasy series, and he did a book about Lovecraft, and he wrote some Lovecraftian stories. But I think the difference between stuff that people like Lynn Carter did and what we have today is that, I mean, Carter just slavishly imitated Lovecraft in the style, and you know, I mean, Block did the same. Block really didn't, I don't think, grew as a writer until he found his own voice.
Yeah, right.
And you've got people like Keyes Johnson. I mean, they're taking the ideas of the Dreamlands, or I think it was Walter Lavelle is doing did the Ballad of Black Tom. I mean, they're taking those ideas, but they're not just reworking it with the same style and stuff. They're reinventing it, and making it much better. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big difference between then and now.
Yeah, the anthology I was thinking of was Mammoth Book of Cthulhu. Paula Gurian was the editor, and it's all mm-hmm. quote unquote new Lovecraftian fiction. It's got a Laid Baron story in there, and I mentioned Variations on Lovecraftian Themes by Veronica Shanoz. I mentioned that it was probably one of my favorite stories of last year, which sort of does the same thing of running the parallel histories between Lovecraft's life and the things that actually happened to him in his stories. But I mean, Sylvia Moreno Garcia is in it. John Langan is in it. A.C. Wise, Yoon-Ha Lee. It's a John Shirley. It's a really spectacular anthology, and was probably the closest thing that reading. It was probably the closest thing to reading Providence when it came to my reception of it. The book was clearly about, look, everybody sort of bristles at the subject of Lovecraft, but everybody in this anthology loves the actual content. And how can we reconcile this? And that was what the book was attempting to do. And I think it did it really well. I would go so far as to say, I think it may have done it a little bit better than Providence itself, because Moore seemed to, basically his theme in this tended to be, look, if all of this was real, then there would be, you know, there would be a lot of baggage that people may not be fully aware of. And that's kind of how it plays out.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, shorter, you know, Courtyard and Neonomicon, where he's really not pushing a theme. He's basically just showing us, okay, where are we going with this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I don't think it works as well as a whole, because really it is, you know, they're releasing it in acts, you know, in the hardcover, probably softcover one day, right? I don't think that they work especially well in acts as much as I think they work individually as issued, building on what you've seen before. And I wouldn't say it's the greatest series as a whole. The Watchmen is much better as a piece of art, right? But individually, the revelations and the interpretations that he does with particular stories really works to me. I found myself, you know, this Robert Black is kind of a bland character, right? He's our everyman. He's our guy leading us to these things, but he doesn't do the logical thing as much as he does the thing that needs to, you know, he needs to visit the next town and get the next story started. And spending those times looking at the panels and seeing Alan Moore's notes on Lovecraft is enough for me to say it was great as an experience individually. Obviously, you know, reworking the stories, you have to deal with what the themes are, right? But it's also profound to me that, like, there are Robert E. Howard stories written by Lovecraft, or Lovecraft stories written by Howard, right? He says, oh, I'm going to do Lovecraft stories. But notice there's no Robert E. Howard stories written by Lovecraft, right? It doesn't go the other way.
Yeah.
The closest he got was one Dreamland story where he had the main character is put in charge of guarding the fort. And manages to fall asleep. And,
right.
You know, then the invasion starts. It's like, oh,
the men of action are not glistening thews and scarlet capes. And, right, they're all.
Or even better is that one, I think it was The Challenge of the Unknown, where they pass the story from one author to the other. So, of course, Lovecraft's character faints. And I think Howard takes the next chapter up and he, like, you know, conquers the alien race. It's like. Oh God!
I mean, I love Howard. I do, but he's got a different thing going on, right? His rugged masculinity, his love of adventure, his gigantic melancholies and mirth, are all great. But he's not the intellectual that Lovecraft is, and he's not grappling, right? With the I read a couple of stories recently by Howard. One. Was his very last Conan story, published in 67, I think. And it's The Veil of Lost Women. And it's great because it's man confronting God in the Garden of Eden, basically, right? Africa. And there's this white woman who needs to be saved from God, basically. A sky god comes down and he can't defeat him.
The Batman guy.
He can't defeat him, but he gives him a good punch. He gives him a good lick and he flies off, you know, and saves the girl. And it's his way of sort of doing the high-minded, deep literary stuff. And he does a pretty good job of it, but it's mostly action, right? Whereas Lovecraft, he looks out in outer space and he's confronted by the awe that is the universe. And he can't be bothered to deal with anything else, right? He's never going to take up another cause once he gets past his imitation stage, which I think is pretty great anyways. He's confronting real stuff and he's doing it in a way that allows people to grip onto it with their own writings or just in reading it or talking about it. That's why we can do a show on a comic book.
Yeah.
we'll do a show about anything.
That's true. So, you know, it's your point that the issues work better than it on a whole. I think that's also serviced by the fact that after a while we had to wait so damn long between issues.
It was pretty slow.
Yeah, which is not a, you know, there had been a number of reports when the series started that the artwork had all been finished, and it's quite clear that that was bullshit. I mean, he was, you know, Burroughs was putting up illustrations from issue 11 on his blog that he had just penciled, or on Twitter that he had just penciled, you know, days after 10 had come out. And it was like, oh yeah, this is going to take a while. Plus all the coloring and all that.
It was worth it though. I got to tell you, his skill as an artist is pretty much unsurpassed.
And
J.H. Williams III maybe, and put him up against him. And I say, yeah, that's a match. Okay.
There's a comfort. I take a weird amount of comfort in being able to eat a chapter of this story and then spend several months digesting it. Once again, it comes down to, you know, what I said about the annotations page. You know, this is all of us overthinking something. But that almost became part of the ritual for me. Mm-hmm. I would read the issue, I'd go back and reread it, and I'd really zoom in my view on the screen so I could go through and look at little things in the background. And then once I got done with it, I'd go and you know, clear a couple hours and read the annotations page. And then I'd go back and read the issue again. And sometimes I'd go back and read all the issues leading up to it. So that when that new one hit, you were never certain when the needle was going to drop.
And, you know, that works with Lovecraft, too. Just straight up, you know, read his text. And then you go back and read it again. It's got all sorts of stuff in there that you missed the first time. At least for me.
Yeah, especially when Robert arrives in Providence and everyone's giving him dirty looks, and then as soon as he gets off the train, he's surrounded by squirmy things. That was one of my favorite opening salvos, and you know, when it came to how to launch a story. So, well, we could probably dive into every friggin' issue for an episode. I'm certain there were a few podcasts that did that while the series was coming out. But if you have an inkling into Lovecraft or any interest in the new Lovecraftian fiction, which is basically pretty much tackling a lot of the baggage that Lovecraft brings with him, then I highly recommend reading this. It was also reading an Alan Moore comic is unlike reading anyone else. And I'm not going to say he's the best at manipulating the medium, because sometimes, quite frankly, he puts too much, he loses all sense of timing and pace when he, you know, like Lee of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, you're going to have to go back just to see what all the literary references are on the bookshelf and things like that. But he purposely will drag things out so that you can actually look at all these lush details that he's put in to the story and that Jason Burroughs has illustrated in the background. And it works on one level, but at the other level, Moore is saying, hi, read the story, and I want you to see all this crap in the background. You don't have to deal with it now, but if you want to go back and look at it, you can see all these other things that are being impacted by the actions that are happening on camera. It's a unique style of doing it. Lord knows plenty of other people tried to imitate it with very little success. But Moore isn't so much interested in telling you a story as much as giving you a glimpse into a world and trying to show you how fully formed it is in his mind. And this coming out at the same, you know, concurrently with his novel, Jerusalem, which was a similar immersive experience that worked better as an immersive experience than as a story.
Often the case when we're
right. And it's fascinating to do it, because to see somebody actually utilize the medium that well for that singular purpose, you know, he's by no means my favorite, but picking up an Alan Moore comic, you always know is going to be something that you know, something unlike anything else, you know, and that goes true for when he was doing superheroes, when he was doing licensed characters. I mean, hell, you know, Rob Liefeld handed Alan Moore his universe, and Alan Moore made it readable. He made it readable within pages. He made it intriguing. He made it complex. And he sort of, you know, goofed off with, you know, once again, hi, if you have a universe with superheroes, there's baggage involved and you have to deal with that, you know, which is something that he didn't view as was happening. But
Before we go off, I just want to ask you guys if you actually are reading another series that Moore started called Crossed Plus 100. You seen this one?
I was not a fan of the Crossed series. And so I picked it up. I picked up maybe the first three issues of Crossed. And then I saw Crossed 100 and I picked it up. And he does what he does well with language, and he does what he does well with setting it up. But quite frankly, it all felt to me much like the first issue of Neonomicon, which is probably my least favorite issue that he's out of this sequence that he wrote. And it's the one, you know, and I'm not even a, you know, before they get to Dr. Alvarez in Providence number one, I thought that entire first half of issue one was kind of a little too carefully contrived.
And it was perhaps beautifully set up. It was beautifully set up, but it does not follow from, or it does not, not everything follows from that necessarily until we get quite deep into the story.
Right. And that's, but, and that's something else. I mean, quite frankly, the reason he takes this, the reason he goes to see Dr. Alvarez is because Prissy makes the comment about the fictionalized version of the Yellow King there. And I was like, well, wait, you know, why aren't we talking about her at all? You know? If she's the one that started this, is she in on it? You know, it kind of becomes how many people are in on this whole Stella Sapien thing and how deeply are they entrenched?
So, but well, no, I think it's playing with the King in Yellow, which doesn't, you know, it doesn't pay off as, I mean, the whole, it's almost like Lovecraft's universe is within the King in Yellow universe in a certain sense, right? It's a subpart, which is kind of, I mean, that's, it's not really just Lovecraft. It's also a bit of Bierce, right? Tiny bit of Bierce and definitely a lot of Chambers. Although the decoration is all Lovecraftian. But I do want to point out that what Cross Plus 100 does is it takes the crossed universe, which is basically a kind of zombie apocalypse story, and it sets 100 years in the future, and then the main character is a, her name is Future Taylor, which is a good name, and she's a basically a archivist, a preservationist of old books, specifically science fiction books, and each chapter, like the chapters in Providence, you know, they all have meaning for Lovecraft stories, right? White Apes is one of the title. That's a Lovecraft story, if not the original one. Facts in the Case of Providence takes it from Facts in the Case of Arthur German and His Family, right? This game, in the case of Cross Plus 100, each takes a science fiction novel title, so an Olaf Stapleton title. And it it does a little bit of what science fiction is doing, is setting it in the future. It's a little bit of Anthony Burgess with Clockwork Orange, and it is worth pursuing. But if you don't have the background in Crossed, which is a pretty brutal background, and it's a very long series, and you really don't need to read all of it. It's funny because it's more of this esoteric stuff, but with a much more recent property. Alan Moore riffing on Garth Ennis. And his riff is that, you know, it's all well and good to talk about zombies, but evolution is actually always happening, even with zombies, right? Mm-hmm. And that hardness of science fiction is sort of a nice counterpoint to the fantasy elements that are going on in here. I mean, Lovecraft, I don't think of him as a fantasist really at all, unless you're talking about Dreamlands, right? I think of him as a science fiction guy. But it feels a lot more fantasy in here for some reason. And it's a nice counterpoint with a very nice hardness of Alan Moore's great storytelling. And he hands it off to somebody else. And, you know, it's it's worth reading the first volume if you like the Crossed series, which is hard to do because it's pretty brutal. Mm-hmm. But it's got great art too.
Mm. Yeah, we did one issue on the science. We did one episode of this show on the science fiction of Warren Ellis. If we tried to do one about Alan Moore, it would probably.
Yep.
Yeah. We'd slowly go mad. Definitely. So, anyways, while we got you here, Jesse, we do a little thing once in a while that we call Culture Consumed. I know we took that title from somewhere. I forget where.
Galactic Suburbia.
That's right. Where basically we talk about what's been in front of our eyes and in our brains since last we spoke. And we always ask our guests, what have they been reading or what have they just finished and what did they think of it or watched?
Okay. Well, I tend to go backwards. I don't hang out in the present very much. So I just finished a show on We Can Build You by Philip K. Dick, right. Which is a very weird novel. For him, it's told in first person, which he doesn't normally do. And as often happens, I don't like some of the elements in some of his lesser-known books, or I don't like it as a whole. But in talking about it and thinking about its place in understanding Philip K. Dick, it becomes greater. And I end up quite liking it, even though it is not his best book. In some ways... it's also called A. Lincoln Simulacrum, Abraham Lincoln Simulacrum. It's in some ways people can perceive it as a prequel to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It has many of the character names in there, and it deals with artificial people. But it is not a great work like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But if you're reading all of Philip K. Dick's works, it still is worth reading. It's almost, he described it when he tried to sell it as his hybrid of mainstream novel, which he didn't have any success selling, and science fiction. And it feels a little bit like that, but it's still worth reading, even though it is a hybrid. So there's that. And then I like watching old movies that I haven't seen before, but have heard of, and Mr. Jim Moon of the Hypnagoria podcast, a terrific podcast, who I have him on my show quite often. He did History of the Werewolf a few years ago on his show, many multi-part series, and he talked about all the werewolf movies. And then he did The Mummy pretty recently and talked about History of the Mummy and read a bunch of stories and then went through the movies. And so I started going through the movies, watching the original Mummy, and then I've seen, of course, the Hammer version. But the most recent one I watched was called The Mummy's Hand, which is a 1940 American mummy sequel, kind of. It's a kind of quasi-sequel. It's only 65 minutes long, and it's public domain, so you can download it and watch it. And it's almost a comedy, but it's that's because some of the characters are cute. But it's a great. I love watching old movies I never heard of before.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure I saw that as a kid on Creature Feature or Chiller Theater or one of those. Mm-hmm. Sure, I've seen it there. What was the Boris? I mean, speaking of mummies, there was a British Boris. I think it was Boris Karloff one. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember what the name of that. That was a pretty good one. I have to dig that up sometime.
Well, Hammer did a terrific one with Christopher Lee. As the mummy.
Yeah, the one I'm thinking of was like circa World War II.
Okay.
It might have been even been earlier than that. So.
I've only watched two of the mummy movies so far.
Karloff was in the original Universal
one. Sure.
Right. But I might be conflating a couple of movies together at this point. Who knows?
Yeah, that was 32. I'm trying to think if he was in any others, because all those Universal players were.
Well, this was definitely British because they had a really weird censorship notice at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, the film board has determined that, you know, and just like, okay, I don't see why you guys were all concerned, because this is really kind of.
Well, they were very strict over there. I mean, way stricter than the Hays Code, and until it wasn't. And then you start getting movies like Raw Meat in 1972, which is a kind of a remake of, a telling of that Robert Barbour Johnson story I mentioned about chuds, you know, creatures in the underground that are on the subway that are going to eat you if you go down there. Mm-hmm.
That's funny. Is there anything else you've been watching or reading?
I'm going to watch The Mummy's Ghost, but I haven't started that one yet. That's right. The next one in the
set.
It's 44. No, it's a, as far as I can tell, it's a straight up Mummy sequel. It's set. Mm-hmm. I think I did start watching it. It's supposed to be set 30 years after the events of the previous movie, but it was only 4 years later, and it has not gone into the future. So they're not super consistent. I guess, you know, when you don't have a VCR and you can't tape the movie off of TV, you know, your memory might fade over what the sequel said 4 years ago.
Right.
So no, I'm. Other than that, I think that's about it for right. very recent stuff.
How about you, Fred?
Well, of course, I did a lot of reading for this.
No doubt.
I just, speaking of Conan, I just finished rereading the first collection. I think it was Del Rey did it maybe 5-6 years ago, where they restored the text mm-hmm. and included fragments and stuff. So that was a fun little read. Mostly been reading this stuff, and in relation to it, I've been going through things like old episodes of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast mm-hmm. and The Double Shadow, which covers Clark Ashton Smith, to refresh my memory on some of their stuff. And my daughter is now studying Gothic stories in her English class, so awesome. She actually asked to borrow a collection of Lovecraft, so she's reading the Library of America edition, and as a result of that, we are now on a bit of a Lovecraft film kick, mm. so we saw the animated version of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath,
mm.
Done by Jason Thompson, who is known as Mockman.
Mm-hmm. I have his Twitter. Book.
Right, he did that book as well. So there's a movie version of it, which is, as they say, limited animation, but I like it a lot. And then we've got a black and white silent version of Call of Cthulhu mm. and a talky version of The Whisperer in Darkness. These are both done by what is known as the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. And they did a silent version of Call of Cthulhu because it's supposed to be filmed the year that the story took place. So, of course, at that point, the films were silent.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they did The Whisperer in Darkness, of course, the year that that takes place, the movies now have sound. And, you know, they're both, like, low-budget, you know, quote-unquote amateur productions, but true to the story, and really, you know, a lot of love goes a long way to compensating for a budget. And some of the same folks have done other shorter films, in which I put links of all these in the show notes. For example, they did one called The Ordeal of Randolph Carter, which is basically a pastiche of The Statement of Randolph Carter. Then there's Pickman's Guest, which is a hilarious version of, you know...
Yeah, I've heard of these, guy. Yeah.
They're on YouTube.
He's invited over to see Pickman. Yeah, they're on YouTube. And then the third one is From Beyond the Beyond,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, he takes that story, which is done in, of course, in Providence, where you see the creepy crawlies if you wear the ultraviolet spectacles. So these are all very amusing. I mean, if you ever have listened to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, they cover all the stories, but they do it, you know, with a grain of salt and a lot of humor. Mm-hmm. And it makes it's a really great podcast that's been going on. Probably almost as many episodes as yours, but not quite.
It's pretty terrific. Yeah. Those HPLHS guys also do the audio dramas that are terrific. Yes. And they just announced the next one. Can't remember which one it is, but it's...
I think they're doing The Haunter of
the Dark. Yeah, The Haunter of the Dark. That's it.
That's the one. And then another thing I'll link to, speaking of real locations and stuff, there is a site called Scouting New York, which is mostly done with the eye of doing, the guy, I believe, works as a film location scout for films in New York. So he does a lot of, stuff like he'll look for old, various chain stores, you know, like the original Duane Reade and what's changed. And he's uncovered various theaters that have now become totally different by finding hints of the architecture. So he wrote a piece several years ago called The Secret Courtyard on Purry Street, which covers the locations in things like that one Lovecraft story called He. Mm. And I believe he might also talk about some of the Red Hook locations. So that's a really good article, so I'll include that as a link. And otherwise, we've started watching the new season of Doctor Who on BBC America, as well as the spin-off series called Class, which is pretty strange for a kid's show, quote-unquote. Or maybe it's a YA show.
I've not had much luck with spin-offs.
Well, I think the problem is that BBC in the UK kind of has got this weird way of treating what is probably their most profitable property at this point, since Top Gear is pretty much dead.
Jesse, to add to what you just said, they don't have luck, but my God, it's not for lack of trying.
They try every 10 years or so, they put out another six shows.
They did, you know, the amount of work that they put into Adventures of Sarah Jane and making it a kid's show, you know, purposely making it a kid's show and treating the adventure that way. And then somebody goes, let's just make Torchwood utter carnage, you know, and let's make horrible things happen to think the characters in Providence have a rough time. The victims in Torchwood are constantly.
Yeah, I mean, for a kid's show, this is more Torchwood than Sarah Jane.
Yeah.
So
I did like the teacher, the one who's guarding the prince there. I did like her.
Yes. Yep. So that's pretty much what I've been doing. You know, more short stories than novels at this point, just because the Project from Heck is consuming all my brain cycles and. You know, short stories is all I can handle.
Yeah. I haven't actually read much fiction in the lab. I've been reading a lot of nonfiction, doing some research for a piece I'm working on. I watched the end of Expanse, which ended quite nicely, dab smack in the middle of the book, and was a nice little wrap up. And I've been watching Doctor Who, and I have been watching old episodes of Kung Fu, the series.
Oh my goodness.
The series, not Kung Fu the Next Generation from the 90s.
Yes.
I like The Legend Continues quite a bit, actually.
I'm actually planning on watching it again at some point because there was an episode on and my wife and I watched it and she started getting into it. She had never seen the show when she was a kid. So we watched all the first season. And we're about six episodes into the second season, and they just showed everything on Decades. I know H&I Network was showing episodes, and then Decades did a binge of seasons two and three. So we're going to try to watch them all in order. It's funny seeing all the familiar guest stars who went on to do great things. And something I was not aware of, but Ramatis Perry, who played young Kane, the child Kane, he's the only surviving member of the cast.
Oh,
I've read that quite by accident. In fact, my wife was, you know, there was one episode where there was a guest star and my wife was reading up on the guest star on Wikipedia and it turned out he died in a domestic violence accident or something like that. And she goes, you know, I'm watching these characters and I'm really coming to love these characters. And I can't help but think how horrible all these, the horrible
curse
ways
of Kung Fu
dies. Yeah.
Well, by that logic, Iron Fist, everybody will live forever.
So it's been fun watching that. And they sort of brush up against the Fantastic a couple times. There's one episode called The Brujo, which is about a guy who supposedly curses a town because the Spanish Don who runs the town killed his wife some years before. And there's a strange albino boy who seems to have control over birds and stuff like this. And it borders on it. It gets into it once in a while, but it doesn't really explicitly. Kane himself is not a believer in the supernatural by any means, but it does brush up against the Fantastic once in a while. So
you're not saying there's an episode where Kane fights a Venus probe from the Soviet Union or anything?
No. No, I think there is. I think there is an episode where the girl who has premonitions.
Okay.
Season three, but I
watched it barely when I was a kid when that was on, so I just barely saw it. But my mom loved it, and I think that Legend Continues with David. It was still David Carradine, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Or at least he visits if he's not doing all the kung fu. was pretty terrific. That whole PT, Primetime Entertainment Network,
yep,
that happened late.
Oh yeah.
Late one night, actually had a lot of great shows in it.
Yeah. It did. I worked at a UPN affiliate when they started running that stuff.
It was a pretty good idea, and it didn't last. Although some of the shows from it lasted.
But that was surprisingly. That was when everything was syndicated. Every TV show was syndicated. You had The Cape, and you had Lazarus Man, and you had the revamped WKRP, and all those, Xena and Hercules, and all of those syndicated shows. And nothing is syndicated anymore. There is no such thing as syndicated shows anymore. It's all, everybody shows up on a small network somewhere. So,
and then it all shows up on Netflix eventually.
Yep. Yes, right. It does. So yeah, so that's been about it for me. That's been about it for me. I really haven't been doing much, but I did want to reread everything of the more Lovecraft sequence leading into it. But and Lord knows we could exhaust this subject. But well, Jesse, I really want to thank you for coming on and chatting
Thanks
with us.
For having me.
I'm glad we were able to get somebody who is as enthused about both Moore and Lovecraft as I tend to get once in a while. Lord knows Fred's been putting up with me talking about this for long enough. Because I think it was probably around issue 4 when the depth of what Moore was doing really became apparent that I said, okay, we're going to have to talk about this. There's no way we can avoid talking about this at this point. So,
Yep.
It lived up to the hype, I would say.
Oh, I definitely think so. I definitely think it did. So, I think he would have been better served saying it was going to be a 10-issue series and then just giving us 2 extras as opposed to... So,
right. We wouldn't have had all these extra covers. That's what I say.
Yeah, that's true. It's true, yeah. Extra covers.
And I want to echo Jeff's thanks and recommend once again everyone check out SFF Audio.
Oh, yes.
Both the podcast and the site, just as a resource.
I heartily concur.
Thank you so much.
So, Jesse, thank you for coming on. Fred, thank you for facilitating everything, as always. And to the listeners, we will be back next month with another episode.
Only monthly?
Yeah, we're only monthly.
You're lucky dogs.
Yeah. Not for lack of trying, but just trying to get the 3 of us to sync up at any point is difficult enough. So,
I used to do my podcast at 5 a.m.
Oh.
Because I'm on the West Coast. It's easy for other people to do it at 8, right? On a Sunday, unless they're going to church. And the ones who didn't need to go to church, they could go after. But that meant I had to get up early. I don't think it works for you guys.
Right. No, we normally it.
No. So.
All right. Well, we hope everybody is having a good spring, and we'll talk to you all shortly.
Holy cow, 2 hours.